Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Brian, thank you so much for doing this, buddy.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. I don't get a chance to be interviewed or talked to too often, so I always like it. I'm always up for anybody that, you know, wants to talk about whatever. So thanks, you know.
And I think that's a shame because, like, you know, one thing, we're friends. We've known each other for a long time now. I consider us friends. I don't want to put that on you if you don't consider me a friend. But
are you kidding me? No, I consider you a friend. Well, sure.
Good. Okay.
You know, you can be friends with people that you don't see hardly at all.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you have that connection, you can always like
pick up
where you left off of. Yeah. Even if it's like, you know, 6 year gap or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I would consider you a friend, yeah.
Okay, good. So cause that would be a really awkward start if you're like, more like an acquaintance. And I'm like, okay, well, we'll go from there.
I mean, I was definitely, you know, I'm a fan of the band you sing in. And you were, like, you know, you guys were like one of the few bands that, for me at least, seemed to kind of stand out after, you know, all that double negative stuff and being exposed to all these, you know, newer bands and stuff. And I was like, I wouldn't listen to this at home. And those other guys in the band were like, had your Hidden World record. And I was like, I like how this is put together, you know, so, and I still own it. So there you go.
Well, Ryan, I really appreciate that. But also, like, back to what you're saying, not being interviewed very often, that is a shame. And I know I've talked to you about this, you know, today, that, like, you're one of the people when I've envisioned doing this whole podcast that I'm like, I have to talk to, because we'll get into all of it, and I shouldn't just, you know, waste the time doing this preamble, but I want to say
sure.
Thank you for giving me some time on a precious day off while on the road.
Not a problem. You're giving me something to do, you know? So.
Well, that's awesome. But, well, I guess I'm going to start them off the way I start them all off, which is, you know, because there's so many places to go. This is going to be a really deep one, people. How did you get into punk?
How did I get into punk? Well, yes. I was always into, like, you know, rock music, you know, and things like, you know, the Beatles and stuff like that. And I seemed to gravitate toward music because I was the classic middle child in my family. And, you know, my family was pretty bizarre, like most families are, you know, when you scratch the surface and, you know, whatever. And being the middle kid, I just always felt like, I'm kind of the ignored one here. And I just would kind of go off and draw stuff. You know, apparently I started drawing when I was 3 years old, which I can't remember, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess as time went on, I just kind of realized I liked music a lot. And then, you know, I would start hearing things and just going, oh yeah, I like that stuff. And, you know, eventually I got into things like, you know, Kiss. Kiss was like the gateway band for a lot of people my age or whatever. They were hard to resist, you know. They looked really scary and it was really bizarre. And I took everything at face value, you know. Like, oh my God, that guy really is from another planet, is he? I'm like 9 or 10 years old. Couldn't really suss that out. And then got really into, they were the gateway. So, you know, of course they were obsolete pretty quickly after 1977. So along comes, you know, Aerosmith and Queen. And I remember when Van Halen's first album came out, which blew me away. And then at the same time, I was kind of aware of Devo and, like, you know, the Sex Pistols album and things like that, the Ramones. But to me, I guess I just didn't, I thought it was like kind of like comedy rock, I guess. You know, it just seemed kind of like a joke. But, like, you know, I kind of liked it, but I didn't have that pivotal whoa moment that so many people had when they heard that stuff. I mean, I liked it, but I was still into UFO and, you know, whatever, and Iron Maiden's first couple records and got into Motorhead, and that was like around 1980-81. And then eventually I started hearing about all the stuff that happened in my backyard. I mean, not really in my backyard. I lived in Simi Valley, California, which is like 40 miles away from Hollywood, but it might as well have been a million years, you know? So, you know, Black Flag, Germs, Circle Jerks, and stuff. And there was this guy, Ronnie Bingenheimer, that had a radio show, which I'm sure you've heard about. And that was real pivotal, you know? Before hearing Ronnie Bingenheimer, it was like, you know, a lot of classic rock stuff, and then listening to this sort of comedy DJ named Dr. Demento.
Yeah, I put out all those Dr. Demento records, and yeah, like,
yeah, yeah.
Played novelty songs.
Spike Jones, Cheech and Chong, all that, yeah. You know, whatever. And like, in a weird way, it seemed like a lot of people, and I could be wrong here, but I feel like a lot of people probably started out being into Dr. Demento and then switched over to punk rock and Ronnie Bingenheimer.
Yeah, you're not the first person to say that who's been on the show. Like, someone else brought up Dr. Demento too previously.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going to say, like, was part of the reason you thought of it as comedy rock is because I know from reading Manchild and talking to you that you're a huge SCTV fan. Had you seen...
Oh, yeah. That's still hands down, I think, the gold standard for, you know, comedy television, you know, still. Even if the references are really super old and, you know, whatever, those guys were all... Everybody on that show was just so good, you know, and so funny.
Had you seen the Queen Haters skit by this point? Would you have?
Well, I think the Queen Haters came later when Martin Short joined.
You're right.
I resented Martin Short. Because
Me too.
I thought he had something to do with. I thought he had something to do with Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas quitting at the same time.
Me too.
Catherine O'Hara quit. I was like, who's this guy? I wanted to not like him. I wanted to not like him. But the trouble is, he was also really funny too.
I actually really resented Martin Short until like I think I got into the Best Show and found out about Clifford and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, he's really funny. He's just as good as all those guys. But at the time, you know, I was like, who's this guy? Like he really had something to do with that. I'm just going to come in here and get rid of these three cast members.
Yeah, I'm going to fire these guys and replace them.
Later, guys.
Yeah, if you want me on this show, these guys are gone.
Yeah. Fuck these guys. Nobody cares about these guys. They're going to do that Canadian content crap or whatever.
Yes.
That's the funniest thing about that. It was like, that's what broke SCTV. That was by far I understand the joke. I mean, I'm not Canadian, but I understand the joke. And it just totally, it seemed like it was a great thing and totally backfired at the same time, you know, because it's like, you know, it was just a stupid stereotype of Canadian culture. And that's what caught on, and that's what caught on in the States. It was massive. I remember it was huge. That Takeoff A and all that crap, it was huge.
But I think that's also, that was for Canadians. I think that's written for Canadians, because Canadians, like, have you ever watched the Kroll Show that's on TV now?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay, well, the Kroll Show has this Wheels Across Ontario sketch, which is playing off of Degrassi, and Canadians love it. Canadians love people making fun of Canadian stereotypes. In Canada, for some reason.
Right, right. Well, and what's also weird, you know, besides all that, is that it seems like some of my favorite people in comedy are Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought the Kids in the Hall was, you know,
amazing.
I got a chance to see their stage show just out of the blue. Some friends of mine and all. I said, "We have this extra ticket. Do you want to go?" And at first, I said no because I guess I had just dropped off my daughter at her mom's house up the street, and I was like, I'm tired. And I really wasn't tired, but,
yeah.
You know. Like, when you have a kid, it's like a good excuse to get out of doing things that you don't want to do.
Yep.
But yep. Sometimes it goes both ways. Like, you kind of get carried away, and I hung up and went, oh, I do want to go do that, and I called them back. And I went, and they were really funny, you know?
Yep.
That show, I thought, was really good.
And they're punk rock dudes, too.
That's right.
Bruce McCullough's right. Like a hardcore kid or punk rock kid, and like I think a couple other ones were definitely punk rock kids back then. So it all comes back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're into underground music and culture or whatever version of that was going on back then. You know, so.
Gerard from Matador has this like amazing story about putting together the Brain Candy soundtrack and how they all came in with like different requests on what bands they wanted on it. And it's a pretty, anyway, but let's not go down that path. Let's get back on the path because we are heading into the Simi Valley, which is, you know, you say you're down the road from where all the great stuff was happening. A lot
sure.
of amazing music to me is coming from right where you are. So let's get back into
you mean
it.
Like you mean like Oxnard and stuff?
Oxnard, but even it came from Simi Valley comp with America's Hardcore and like, I think Scared Straight's on that too, right? You guys are on that?
I don't think Scared Straight's on it.
No.
But you know, it's really funny. It's like you have just given me the third or fourth. It came from Slimy Valley.
Slimy Valley, yes.
Melvin's tour started. All that that keeps coming up.
Well, like, you've run into me.
Yeah, I remember that.
This is the third time we've talked on the Melvin's tour so far. So are you sure it's not me bringing it up three times to you?
No, it wasn't you. It was like two or three other people. And then the other day, you know, like we've had this long running joke for years. That band NoFX had that song making fun of this promoter guy named Bob Durkee.
Yeah.
You know. And they had this stupid song about it. Bob Durkee was really funny. He's a really cool guy. He had this, taught all these shows in Los Angeles at the Sun Valley Sportsman's Lodge around night, like 84, 85. I saw all kinds of stuff. And NoFX wanted to play. And Bob was like, I'd love to have you guys play a show for me. There's only one problem. You guys suck. I hate you guys. You guys are fucking terrible. I mean, you guys are nice guys. Don't get me wrong, but you'll never play a show for me. And then they wrote that song, like, we're going to get back at you. So ever since that song came out, for 20-something years, me and Buzz have had this joke about, Bob Durkee's a dick. He's totally a dick. And we'd listen to that song. I mean, running jokes into the ground is a Melvin staple. So it's like playing that song 30 times in a row. Just the stupid. The more you do it, the stupider it gets, you know, that kind of humor. But Bob Durkee was a pivotal promoter for a lot of that stuff, too. And also the Nardcore stuff, too. I know those guys played his shows. I'm trying to ring it back to what you were trying to say initially.
Well, no, I'm just trying to get... I just want to get back to you. Sorry, before I cut you off with my historical inaccuracy about SCTV, let's get back to your story.
I just went off on a big tangent. So
no, that's the show, buddy. You know this. This is what makes the show hopefully entertaining for people, are the tangents.
Bob Durkee's really a dick. I mean, he signed posters the other day and wrote, you know, Bob Durkee's a dick. You know, show posters that people make.
Yeah.
They sign them, and he's like, Bob Durkee's a dick. I love Doug Moody. You know, people came up to me, are you Doug Moody? Yes, I am. I'm Doug Moody. You know, stuff like that. Just stupid stuff that nobody's going to get or care about. All right. Let's go back to you.
No. Let's, like, believe me, I want to talk all about Doug Moody in 2 seconds, I think. So, what was the first show you went to? Do you remember, like, the first kind of punk show you went to?
I do, because like what happened was like I finally got hip to like the first record I got was Damaged by Black Flag, which just blew my mind. And I listened to, I was so into the first side of the record that I listened to it like a week straight before I even flipped the side. I just kept playing it over and over and over, you know. And then I got aware of Flipside magazine and, you know, started buying, you know, TSOL, Adolescence album, first Circle Jerks album. I even bought the Christian Death album, and then, you know, I was getting really into the music, but I didn't have any friends, and I was, you know, pretty much invisible. And I realized through like reading Flipside, you know, which is like reading a whole new world when you open up a Flipside from 1982, like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, that you could be like a letter writer and that kind of thing. And you could, you know, could communicate that way. So I started doing all the stuff like a year before I was able to go to a show. And the first show I was able to go to was in Restita, California at the Country Club. And I saw, it was 45 Grave, Texan and the Horseheads, Red Cross with, that lineup was the McDonald Brothers, of course, and Des Cadena was in the band playing second guitar.
Oh,
it was right before they were going to do that Teen Babes record.
Yeah.
And Des, you know, he quit. And Dee Boone played in sort of a little set by himself too, in between all that. So that was like, you know, those are some of my favorite, you know, I like Red Cross a lot. I like the Minutemen and, you know, obviously Dez and 45 Grave were really good. And I was such a nerd. I took a pad of paper and a pen to the show.
You did?
Yes, I did. And people already knew who, I met some kids that knew who I was. Because I already had stuff printed in like Flipside or whatever, or Maximum Rock. But I just drew stuff from how I imagined, you know, things would be. Which, you know, like draw like some show scene of everybody smiling and happy. You know, there's everybody's in a good time. You know, a good mood, having a good time. I didn't really draw anybody like passed out in their own vomit, you know, from being drunk or some leather clad looking idiot. You know. I didn't do that, you know, and then and the show was definitely like less of a hardcore show, obviously, but more of, but still, you know, I mean, and it was, you know, it was really, it was great. You know, I finally had a chance to to do that. And then at that point, I met some of the Scared Straight guys, like mainly Scott Radinsky, mm-hmm. and he had like this little blue pickup truck. And, you know, me and him became very close, very fast. And, you know, we just set off, so he would be nice enough to drive me everywhere he went. You know, we'd go to all these shows and stuff, and we went to the Café de Grand and saw, you know, I was trying to catch up, you know, and we saw everybody from, you know, Condemned to Death, who were really good. This is like early 84, you know, by the time I was trying to catch up, and, you know, just all kinds of stuff, you know. It was really exciting to finally be able to start going to shows. But yeah, that was the first one, 45 Grave.
How old were you when you had your first cartoon or illustration published, I guess?
Oh God, it must have been, I moved to North Carolina when I was 19, so I think that's what it was. So I'd say 17.
Okay,
maybe.
Awesome. So was that part of
17 years old.
So being an illustrator at that point, like, you know, or being so, like, was that something you wanted to do professionally? Was that your, like...
I didn't even think about that because, A, even though I wasn't really ambitious. I mean, for a long time, I wasn't ambitious. In fact, and I didn't really spend any time on what I was doing. I was just a fan. So I was just drawing out of excitement. I wasn't drawing, like, to make something look good, you know, because that was pretty much beyond me. You know, it took me a long time to realize, oh, you know, you got to spend time on this stuff. Or, you know, I was just drawing out of just the idea that I was a fan, and I certainly didn't have any aspirations, you know. But even so, I still ended up for 2 years, you know, I still, probably a little longer, I just was a massive letter writer, you know, and just wrote. I had so many pen pals, and I just drew whatever for anybody. You know, you want something? I'll draw it. That's how excited I am about the punk scene. I'll do anything, whatever you want, you know. And I got a lot of, you know, I got a lot of attention in a short amount of time, you know. And, you know, like looking back at all that stuff, it's like, I don't think a lot of it was really very good, you know. People always send me stuff. Remember when you drew this in 1985 and it looks like everything else just kind of, and this is just me speaking, you know, kind of, sort of crappy looking, but, you know, spirit's there, you know.
Well, it's almost like your approach to art was the same as everyone's approaches to music in punk and hardcore, which is like, it's about being excited and just wanting to participate, and, like, you kind of, like, worry about the technical aspects later.
Oh, yeah. I definitely worried about the technical aspects much later.
Yeah, but I think that's also why your art is so awesome. Like, you know, obviously your art now is a lot more accomplished, but even the stuff that I see from back then, because the energy, you know, it's like listening to a great punk record that, like, yeah, like, the playing's not as tight, and it's not like Blue Oyster Cult or something, but at the same time, it's like, you know, the passion's there, the excitement's there, the energy, you know?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was really exciting, you know, and then that all culminated with, you know, that 7 seconds drawing that ended up on that record cover. I mean, to this very day, I still hear about that record.
Was that,
that cover.
But the comp, you did the Mystic comp first, the Gnarcore comp, right?
Yeah, I have a good story about that.
Yeah, well, let's see. I'm sorry, I wanted to, before we get to, like, I want to hear that story, but have you started playing drums by this point, or?
I think I was a late bloomer, you know, like, I always, like, hit things with sticks, pots, pans, whatever, and then maybe, like, 9th or 10th grade, I finally got behind a real drum kit, and lo and behold, I was like, oh, I can actually naturally do this. So, and I bought this, like, crappy little drum set right before I met Scared Straight, or before they asked me to play, and I guess I had some kind of knack, I guess. I bought this drum set at some Simi Valley place, and I was so green, I didn't even know that cymbals didn't come with the drum set. I had no idea. So when I got the drum, where are the cymbals? Well, you have to buy them. Oh, okay. So I used a lead pipe for a little while until I could afford, you know, to buy cymbals, whatever, you know, and I would practice my little, you know, whatever. And eventually I was already friends with the Scared Straight guys, and they knew I played a little bit, and then I guess they asked me to play. That was the first band I was in. So it wasn't that long at all. It was like a really short amount of time, like maybe a year and a half of having a drum kit.
Were they going by that point as a band, Scared Straight, before you joined?
Were they what now?
Did they have another drummer before you joined?
Oh, they had two drummers before me.
The two
guy named James that I placed, and the original drummer was Scott. Scott played drums.
Scott played and drums he, in that first? Wow.
Oh, yeah. He started out as a drummer.
Did he play on a record, or is it a demo or anything like on drums, or?
I believe he's on the Nardcore songs.
Oh, just on the Nardcore songs. Okay.
On those two. And then he switched over. Well, he already had switched over to singing. No, actually, that's not true. No, James was on it. So, yeah, Scott's not on anything. They recorded a silly little demo that I remember hearing, you know, like right before that. But, yeah, the guy in between me and Scott played on the two songs.
So, played on those two songs. Okay. And so... Right. How did you first come in contact with Doug Moody and what is the Mystic Records empire, which your early life is tied to?
Well, Doug Moody was like this weird 50-year-old single guy. It was kind of hard. I met him through Scott. I don't know how Scott met him, but like he just, Mystic Records and Doug Moody were just the kind of people that if you were in a band that really wasn't that great, that really had no chance of being signed to SST or Frontier or anybody else, Slash. You know, can you imagine anybody on Mystic Records being on Slash? Right? You know, it just never would have happened because we were all just like, you know, competent, sort of semi-generic hardcore in some of those cases. And what probably made it generic was just how horrible the record sounded. And we just, they had an office like across the street from the Cafe de Grand. I remember that. And we would just hang out there. You know, I don't think Doug, he didn't seem like he was a bad guy or anything like that, you know, but it just seemed kind of weird. Like why is this 50-year-old English guy? Why does he want to record all these, like, you know, hanging out with El DJ or whatever, you know, why is he doing this?
Yeah.
And probably because he was making some money, you know, I don't think he was making a lot of money. I could be wrong. You know, people are still mad about all that. You know, Doug Moody. But Doug Moody, all they did was put out all these records by bands that probably, you know, to be honest, wouldn't have never had a chance to have a record come out. We knew that. Scared Straight knew that. We were like, yeah, that's cool. I mean, you know.
How did the deal work?
For whatever it's worth, you know.
How did the deal work? Did you guys get a bunch of records up front? Or was there any sort
of,
like...
Yeah, we got a bunch of records, and that was it. And we kind of knew that would be it, you know. You know, but also we weren't, you know, we didn't have careerists. I mean, I was only in the band a really short time. It seemed like it was forever, but when I look back, it was less than a year. But it seemed like it was 5 years. You know, like when you're a kid, everything seems like it, you know, time is much slower. So it was one of those things. I mean, I think I came back and played with them like a second time for a tour, like later on, when the guy that replaced me couldn't go. But that initial first period, we recorded the Mystic record, and we partied with Doug Moody, and I met the Faction, and just, you know, weird little things like that.
Were you a skateboarding fan? Was meeting Steve Caballero like a big deal to you, meeting the Faction, or?
No, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, I'm not very sports-minded person, you know, I could barely stand on a skateboard, you know. I admired it, you know, but I wasn't athletic, and everybody else in Scared Straight were, you know, very athletic looking, you know, tall and broad and stuff. And
we had a future like pro ball player.
Semi pudgy Jewish looking guy with a mop of hair. And go, hey, I can draw, you know, check. Look at this pit drawing. Everyone's smiling. Yeah, stuff like that.
Was Scott at that time, was he playing like pretty serious baseball too?
He must have been, you know, like we were all aware of his career and knew about like a burgeoning career. But, you know, like to this day, I still don't, you know, I'm not a baseball fan. It was only through like other people that I realized just what he accomplished, you know. And then like last year we hung out for like a couple days at his house. And that was really great. You know, that was a lot of fun. But at the time it was just like, well, okay, you got practice. All right, you're playing a show. And then you already had people scouting him before he got out of high school, you know. But again, that wasn't really anything I knew about or was into, you know. So to me, it was just like, oh, that's cool, baseball career. But I didn't really think anything else, you know, beyond that. And I was, you know, and then I was gone before, you know, things picked up for him. I just wasn't really aware. I sang for him in place of him one show because he had baseball.
You sang a Scared Straight show?
I did.
Whoa.
It was, yeah. I don't know what to say about that. It was, somebody taped it, and I was like, oh, I don't need to hear that. But I did. I was like, yeah, I sure can't sing. Oh, well. That's the way it goes, you know.
So there is tape of it? I gotta see this.
Somewhere there's a tape of it. You know? I wouldn't know who had. I mean, I might still have it, but I don't think anybody would be really missing out if they didn't hear it, even if they really were into Scared Straight.
Well, for historical record, Brian, I think I need to hear it. But we can move on from this painful memory
scarred me for life.
Yeah, scarred you for life. So I guess like the Doug Moody thing, he's always been like a fascinating human being to me. Cause like, as you say, he's older. That label was going way before he latched on to the Nardcore stuff, right? Like he was putting out records in the '70s, like the mid '70s or something.
Did he? I didn't know. I think like I was first aware of Mystic Records because they put out that Mentors 12-inch.
I think,
which I thought was hilarious. And I was like, this is really funny.
He also put out the Aryan Disgrace hard F-bomb in the family song, you know, that 7-inch?
I've heard of the name, and I'm sure I've probably seen it, but I can't recall hearing it. But, a lot of people really right away hated Mystic Records because they all thought everything was just generic crap and sounded horrible and stuff. So right out the gate, even though a lot of people liked it, it seemed like there was just as many people, probably more people, that were just like, you know, what is this bullshit, you know? But, you know, that's how it was. I really have no idea why he was involved in what he was doing. And the only reason I can think of is that he made some money. You know, I mean, really, you know, I'm really into putting out Ill Repute Halloween Live. It's a vinyl recording. You know, this is going to be kind of like a Miles Davis record, you know? I mean, he must have made some money. If he didn't make any money, I couldn't see why he would do it. Why would he do it? Maybe, he seemed nice enough, you know? I mean, he seemed nice enough to me, but it was always just this weird thing. Why are we going down to Hollywood to hang out with this 50-year-old? Why is he putting out all these records, you know? We just couldn't figure it out. I mean, and, you know, there's some good stuff that came out on Mystic, but, you know, not much. I would definitely include, you know... It is what it is. And years later, I'd always run into people that were fans of all that stuff, and that's cool. But especially when Double Negative started, I'd meet all these kids that were like, yeah, we're really into all that Mystic stuff. We really like how the productions, you know, they thought that the record sounded that bad on purpose, like it was the Mystic sound. Like people were really trying to make really bad sounding records. And I was like, no, that's just how the record sounded. You know, I think everybody involved would have liked to have had a good recording, you know, but that's, you know, some bands are luckier than others, but it was just really funny because people were just thinking that it was like, you know, Doug Moody and his wall of sound, you know, like Phil Spector could put a few tips from Doug Moody. But, you know, he recorded that Led Zeppelin drum track, you know, but yeah, I mean, you were kind of cursed in a way.
Did he? So he would record you, right?
He had this like guy named Phil.
Oh, that's
right.
Yeah, Phil. What's the last? It's all credit on all those records too. I should just check.
Yeah, I mean, it was exciting to do it, you know. But I don't think Doug Moody was actually producing the records, but I could be wrong. But it came out how it came out, and I think that Phil guy, he had like some pencil thin John Waters mustache and had a big mop of dyed black hair, and we just banged out, you know, nine songs in, you know, 10 minutes, and there you go.
Philip Raves is his name.
What was it?
Philip Raves.
Philip Raves.
Yeah.
Working for Doug Moody.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably have. And, a lot of people really hated that stuff, and then years later, all these people, like I just said, were like, yeah, it's really cool the way you just get catching that classic bad sound on purpose kind of thing. And it's like, I don't think anybody wanted the records to sound as bad as they did, you know. I mean, but yeah, that would go for anybody, you know.
I love the way they sound, but I totally know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So did the Nardcore comp, that's your first thing you did with them, right? Before the Scared Straight stuff?
I think that's the first thing I drew. You mean like drawing wise?
No, was it that, did that come out before the Scared Straight 7 inches and stuff too? Was that the first thing?
Yeah, that came before that. Yeah, that was the first cover. But I drew it in heavy pencil, and then I gave it to them, and then like it came out, and then they handed me a copy, and it looked really hard. I mean, it wouldn't have looked really too much better probably, but they handed it to me, and it looked really bad. And I was informed that when they were trying to make the cover, put the covers, that because it was heavy pencil, it just wasn't. It wasn't going to work. So instead of contacting me and telling me about it, they had somebody just draw over it with like a marker, and that's the cover. I was like, gee, thanks, you know. So you look at it, and ever since, you know, it's like, you couldn't be bothered to call me? I was like too mortified to say anything just looking at it. Like, oh, God, you know, it's just crazy. And then like those other covers came like a little bit later.
Yeah. So
what do you say? Gee, yeah. Thanks.
Did you get credit?
Here's your free copy. Okay, thanks.
And I guess you're a kid too, so you're just stoked to do it.
I was just stoked to do it. And, you know, I was more stoked than horrified. But I was a little horrified. I mean, I wasn't like, my great art has been ruined. But it was just like, it's just weird. I mean, maybe that Phil guy drew over it. Who knows, you know? Have no idea.
Maybe it was one of the Hernandez brothers. Because weren't they Nardcore dudes?
I kind of doubt that. I think they got. I think from what I can tell, what I've heard, I think I met one of those guys once. And I think from what I can tell, they got really tired of contributing to these people's punk rock stuff really quickly because the story I heard is that, you know, they weren't really treated very nice or they weren't paid or compensated. And I think they got tired of doing that stuff really quickly, which is why I think you see a certain amount of stuff and then you never see anything again.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you bring up a good point though. Like, you know, as a graphic artist in punk rock, kind of like the people that get exploited the most in punk rock, as far as an artistic side of things, are the graphic artists, historically, especially.
Well, leading into this part of it, everybody has like a good Burn, classic Burn story, but, you know, most of that's the fault of the artist, you know. I was just stoked to be doing it, you know. I didn't really think about a future or that a band would actually sell records or whatever, and you know, that stuff just happens, you know. It's really nobody's fault. Ultimately, the responsibility would lie on the artist, and I was just happy to be there. You want something to draw here, you know. I have no idea how many times, you know, something I did was taken and, you know, probably used forever, you know. But that's how it goes, you know. I mean, you know, in some ways it's kind of flattering, you know, but, you know, there's nothing you can do to control any of that stuff. At the time, it was just, people were just running on excitement and there was really no future and nobody was really being business-minded and career-minded. I know I wasn't, you know. That never would have crossed my mind. But, you know, yeah, everybody has a good punk rock burn story from the era, you know. I'm sure Raymond Pettibone, you know, like, you know, the whole, yeah, he drew all those album covers and stuff. I mean, who knows what happened? You know?
Oh, no, he says on Twitter all the time, he got ripped off by his brother. He hates his brother. And, like, he talks, he never gets his originals back. Sometimes they cut up his originals when they gave them back to him. It was like, you know, like, it's certainly an underappreciated aspect of the punk rock package of a record is the graphic arts.
Oh, sure. Totally. You know, I mean, yeah, it's very underappreciated. Kind of along the same lines of how when they talk about all that stuff, they never seem to talk about how important it was that people wrote letters and corresponded with each other. I mean, that was really the secret society of all that stuff, you know, because besides the bands and the magazines, I mean, you know, people doing magazines and creating art, you still had to get in touch with these people and, you know, share stuff. And tons of people did that. You know, I know a lot of people that did that kind of stuff. A lot, and some of the same people that ended up drawing album covers, you know, a lot of those people. Yeah, and they were all fans, you know. Nobody was thinking about a career. I think maybe a few of those guys were probably a little more savvy, but I would imagine that Brian Schroeder was probably a little more savvy.
Well, you could tell I think he was probably the guy that got wise to it the first, maybe, and was able to, yeah, you're right. Like he was the guy who, I guess, wound up doing illustrations for a lot of the bands that got really big and probably never got any money for a lot of that early stuff that he did too.
Sure, totally. I'm sure he was a big fan too. You know, I know he was a big fan, you know.
You bring up that letter writing thing, and I think that letter writing thing is, yeah, I've talked about this with other people. I think kind of like punk rock and, you know, as an outgrowth of like science fiction fanzines and like the letter writing thing that would exist in that kind of world, but like punk collecting, tape trading, and then it became metal tape trading and all that kind of stuff. That to me is...
Yeah, the metal underground picked up, I mean, you know, obviously I can't say that metal underground picked up on letter writing because of punk rock, because anybody would have figured out that you could write letters, you know, if there was enough of this energy in music, you know, it would have happened sooner or later. But yeah, they did the same thing. That metal underground tape trading thing was huge, and that came right on the hills of you know, letter writing. And I'm sure people wrote letters back and forth, you know, before punk rock, you know, obviously.
Well, and I think those are the first examples.
It was really important. It was really important. You know, people never talk about that, and that was like really important. It's funny how that's always glossed over. You know, people doing that that was the secret glue that held everything together for a while. You know, and then, you know, people got tired of it, of course. Yeah.
But I think that's like the first social networks, like the first, like the idea of like having these networks of communities based around shared interest and common interest. That's kind of like the foundation of what we have now with the internet. And it's like,
absolutely,
you know, you see it first kind of in these like people trading tapes with people in Japan, or people trading tapes with people in South Africa, or people trading tapes with people in Brazil, or things like that. Like all over the world, people are trading. And anyway,
I always pick Italy because that band's always had the gnarliest sounding, horribly produced demos of listening to some badly produced, mangled, gnarly hardcore record from Italy in 1985. These guys fight cops on the way home from rehearsal. That's how dedicated they are. You know, they're really screwing the system, or you know, whatever. Yeah, I never would have heard any of that stuff if it wasn't for, you know, picking up a pen and doing all that. None of this would have happened. I wouldn't be talking to you right now if you know, I didn't do that. You know. So in a way, that's responsible for everything.
Which is kind of funny. So I guess at this point, are you going out and touring? You guys played some tours, right? Had you left?
Straight?
Yeah.
We did like an aborted like tour of the country with Ill Repute, and we were 2 weeks into it, and everything was going good. And we played in Pittsburgh, and the next morning, during the night, somebody had broken into our rented U-Haul and station wagon and drove off with everything. And everything. And we got the vehicle back like a day later and everything was gone. So we had to go home. We were going to go like try to keep going. And then we went to Baltimore and Ill Repute had a particularly bad night playing on borrowed equipment. And we did okay. And then it's like, we're done. And then at the last minute I was like, well, I don't want to go home because I've never been on the East Coast before. So I called Reed Mullen from Corrosion of Conformity. Those guys were going to go up to see the Bad Brains in New York City. So, you know, I'd never seen the Bad Brains. I've never been to New York City. And I'm 19 years old. So I'm going, you know. So I go get on the phone and I tell those guys. And I think one of the Scared Straight guys was like, well, we want to keep going. But it would have been like all these guys in the back of a blue pickup van going across the country. You know, not really safe. You know, like I've sat in the back of plenty of pickup trucks. That's definitely nothing I would ever in a million years do now for even the shortest drive. But back then, yeah, I'll drive across the country, you know. And I just went, I can't do that. And So,
well, you would have been arrested. Like, there's no way they would let people drive down the highway even at that time in the back of a pickup truck, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. It was just crazy. The idea was just crazy. I mean, it was like, I kind of want to do it, but to be honest, I think I'd rather, you know, I mean, it just seemed really dangerous, you know. Some part of me must have thought it was really dangerous because I didn't go, yeah, that sounds great. We should do it. You know, we should, you know, this is dangerous. Four guys in the back of a pickup truck, 3,000 miles away from where you live, you have to eventually get back there. You know, God knows what could have happened. Even stranger was the fact that our parents let us go. I look back at that, and I'm like, why did our parents, you know, can you imagine, like, being a parent as you are now, and, like, you're, one of your sons gets old enough, hey, Dad, we want to go on tour. We're going to go across the country and go into the States, and we're going to sit there. You'd be like, fuck, no.
Well, I guess probably.
I would be, but
Josh from our band, he must have been 17, 18 the first time we started touring. Like he was a kid, and we're like sneaking across the border, and not sneaking, but crossing with less than perfect visas at that time.
Right.
And, you know, and it's like, I guess it's like, as a parent by that point, you're just like, all right. Maybe we'll be like that, you know? We'll just be like, all right, do what you want.
just go. I'm sick of you. Go ahead, go on tour.
Yeah,
maybe
go on tour.
Maybe that, our parents. Yeah, I was talking about that with Scott. Isn't that funny that our parents let us do this when we were like 18 and 17 years old, didn't even bat an eye? Yeah, go ahead, do it. Go up, you know, anything could have happened. I look back on that now, I think that's just crazy.
So how did you meet the COC guys?
I was a big fan of some of the North Carolina stuff because through tape trading, I heard there was a band called No Labels that shared members of COC. It was like Reed and Woody were in No Labels along with this guy named Wayne Taylor, who was the singer, and this guy named Ricky Hicks, who played guitar. It was kind of like his band. And he was like, Ricky Hicks is a very kind of upstanding sort of good guy. You know, he was like the closest thing we only had to like a DC sort of person, I guess, like just a solid dude, you know, and he was really into DC stuff. And that band kind of started a little before COC, but both bands shared members. I heard their demo and I was like, man, this is really good. And Reed was just blazing and he had played drums for like a year at that point. And I was really taken with that. And then I heard this Why Are We Here record. It was like a compilation single. I'm sure you probably have.
Yeah, I just actually got it last year, finally.
There you go. And we loved all that stuff. Me and the Scared Street guys, and Scott, and a few other friends, we just played that all the time. And then when the album came out, I got that right away, and they were on tour, and I missed seeing them by like a day or something stupid like that. And I was really taken by that record, and I just kind of started writing to Ricky and Woody, and became very, you know, I heard some of the other bands that were from North Carolina, and I was really kind of infatuated with it, and I just struck up a friendship with them. And I met them for the first time when they came out to L.A. To do Animosity, the side of Animosity, the first side, and that was like January of 1985, and they played like one of the first crossover shows that I was aware of, and the entire audience took a step back because, you know, even though they were like a fast band, they were still different than, say, you know, Dark Angel or Possessed, who played that show. And people had, a lot of those people had to sort of step back and think about what they were saying. They had to make up their minds because, you know, COC wasn't just a straight thrash metal band or any kind of band like that, you know. And that's how I met them. You know, that's literally, and they stayed at my house, my parents' house. I snuck them in through my window and all kinds of stuff. It was like existing. I was like living this life where I was like sort of existing outside of my parents' house, but I was in my parents' house, and they, you know, my parents were fine. Yeah, they're okay, but they didn't really pay any attention to anything I did or whatever. So I could have done anything, but I was still like a goody-goody. So instead of doing typical teenage stuff, I just snuck COC through my window and watched Woody Weatherman back at the van onto the mailbox and break it, and then us popping it up. Having them never know about that to this very day. That mailbox lane's flooding all of a sudden. I wonder what happened. I don't know. Something happened. I don't know. Whatever. Yeah, but that's how I formally met them.
Oh, so I guess you kind of just continued writing letters to them throughout this
I wrote letters to them. Again, everything seemed like it was like a long time, but it was really a really short amount of time. And that's what I did. I just sat in my room. I answered all this mail. I'd get like 8 or 9 letters or packages a day for a long time. And I got to say, it was a, you know, not everybody's going to do something like that. But, you know, I was kind of introverted, and I didn't really have a lot of friends. And I was really into the music and the creative aspects of it. You know, I never drunk a beer until I was like 26 years old. I, you know, some of that stuff, you know, meant nothing to me, or just was intimidating, or just nothing I was into. So I was just into drawing stupid stuff and mailing it to whoever wanted. And that's what I did, you know.
Well, you bring up a good point there, because, or something I wanted to talk about there briefly, is like, as a young straight edge kid, I remember being really excited about Scared Straight, because I was like, oh, it's a straight edge Oxnard band. And then some guy that worked at the record store was like, no, they weren't straight edge, blah, blah, blah. Did you guys, were you straight edge? Because the song Scared Straight is kind of like a straight edge song. And then you're saying you didn't drink a beer till you're 26.
It's kind of. We didn't really identify ourselves. I mean, we liked a lot of, like, you know, of course, Scared Straight was just, we were just looking up to the people that we admired that were, you know, good.
Yeah, like Uniform Choice. And
like, well, not really so much. I mean, those guys came later.
I was joking on that point.
Well, I mean, Uniform Choice, we thought they were fine, you know.
Oh, were you guys into them?
Well, I can't rewrite my history. That guy with Pat was really nice to me, and they had that demo, and yeah, they totally looked and sounded like Minor Threat, and that was a big turnoff for a lot of people. But, you know, I was into them and Slayer at the same time, and, you know, but by the time I had moved to North Carolina, it was pretty much all that stuff was over. You know, like, so by the time they put out their album, I was really not into it. You know, I was not into any of that stuff. And then all the stuff that was coming later, you know, straight at, like, Youth of Today, you know, nice people, but I was like, this is like a joke. You know, this is like a total joke of hardcore. You know, this sounds just like this DYS record, which isn't really the world's greatest record or anything, but at least, you know, that those Toucan Sam vocals and rah, all that kind of stuff. That, I mean, that, to me, that's what I thought. I'm not saying if anybody else liked it that they're an idiot or anything, but, you know. And at the time of Scared Straight, there wasn't really that kind of scene, but there were bands that kind of, you know, we kind of knew them, like Justice League, and, you know, we met Uniform Choice, but, you know, I don't think any of us ever sat down and said, okay, here's the contract we signed to ensure that none of us drink a beer. Or, you know, I think Steve, one of the guitar players, he enjoyed his beer, you know. He was actually having sex, you know, things like that, you know. straight edge by default was probably, there's some truth in that, but the reality is that, you know, the idea of drinking a beer, you know, I just didn't really have any interest in it, you know. I didn't.
Just before we move, had you met the Melvins on the West, when you were on the West Coast by this point?
No, I met them a month after I moved to North Carolina. They were coming through with, oddly enough, RKL on this tour where, you know, the climate of the day was not very receptive to the Melvins. But when they showed up to play, it was like, oh, there's a new sheriff in town. You know, because I was into, you know, Black Flag. That was by far my most influential band on me. You know, I was with them throughout everything until the very end. Like, after they kicked Bill Stevenson out, they were never, you know. And you could probably say that those last two records are eh, but everything they did up until Slip It In, with Slip It In being the last, I was totally into that. So I was also into some little stuff, and I was into, you know, CUC obviously took a page from Black Flag and Black Sabbath, and when Blast, the band Blast, their first album, pretty much only really their first album. That record just blew my mind. I was like, this is genius songwriting, because that guy wrote exactly, it was exactly a cross between Black Flag and something like SSD, and it pulled it off. I still like that record, you know. So when the Melvins came out, oh, and the band Honor Roll. Honor Roll were a huge influence on me. That band from Richmond, Virginia, because they were like the first band that really just went beyond hardcore, had real songs with lyrics that weren't embarrassing and amazing guitar playing. It's not really captured on the records, but live, they were like a steamroller. They were like the equal of any of the bands I talked about. They were like super powerful live, but it was never captured on record.
The records are good, though. Like, I never saw them live.
The records are good, but it's just too bad. There, like, if any of the Honor Roll, if the first Honor Roll record sounded better, you know, like, they might have had the cult audience that, like, say, Slint, with that Spider-Man record had. Because they were, like, contemporaries of them. It could have, you know, Honor Roll are, like, this total unknown gem, and they're great, you know. So when the Melvins showed up, it was like, right away, it was like, oh, there's a new sheriff in town. And they were just, you know, it was just mind blowing. They were the future, and I might be biased here because you know I am, but there's, you know, that still remains to be the case, you know. And people, I remember people didn't like that because they were just basically blowing all these people off the stage, you know, supposedly good bands and stuff. That's always been their problem. That's why they're ignored. That's my theory, you know. Even back then, that you know. Del Crover, you know, he's like, comes through, he's like 17 years old, 16 years old. It's like, Jesus, you know. Now, so, anyway, I'm going off on a tangent a little bit, but.
No, but I want to hear your tangent about the Melvins, because, like, you know, like, I think, I agree with you. I think they're one of those bands, you know, and it's funny, because, like, they're a band that you just talk to people, and they just resonate. When they resonate with you, they resonate really hard.
Oh, yeah. But people do not like them. You know,
no, absolutely. Fat Mike on this show.
A lot of people came to them later. Like, they never went after an audience. The audience came to them. And a lot of big people just always had this chip on their shoulder about them because they were just blowing their bands off the fucking stage. You know, regardless of whether you like that style of music or not, you know, there's just something that Buzz and Dale have when they play together, you know? And also, I think people respond to them because of that underdog status thing, you know? They're not a cool hip band, you know. They're not like a hipster sort of thing, and they never were. And they kind of like, I think they sort of represent the underdog and stand up for the underdog. And I think people can definitely see that. Yeah, you know? And they're disarmingly nice people, and that also throws people like, oh, they're not dicks like all these other people.
But they also keep it real too. Like, it's not like they're gonna like pull punches like to be nice. At the same time, like you know, Dale is one of the nicest people I've ever met, but like you said, they'll stand up for the underdog, and if they see something that he doesn't agree with, like, he'll stand up for that thing, you know.
Yeah, he's not lying. People get really bent out of shape about that, but he, it'd be really hard for me to express just how much gratitude I have toward those guys, you know, on so many levels, you know. And you know, I'll never be able to put into words, you know, how much I've appreciated their friendship and their help. You know, I've never really gotten a lot of help from most people, and I think, you know, philosophically I'm sort of on the same page as the Melvins as far as the attitude about why you do things and your motivation. And you know, that might be, and we also have the same sense of humor. You know, not everybody has the sense of humor, you know. So I've been friends with them ever since that first meeting, and I'm still a fan, you know. And I still, you know, I can't say I've liked every note of every album, you know. You can't, but you know, they have like 40 albums out, you know. But they just we're all, the people that are involved with them, we all definitely appreciate that we've been able to be a part of it on whatever level, and that, you know, like, spreading the wealth somewhat. I mean, not wealth, like, you know, millions of dollars, but, you know, it's a cool thing. You know, it's good to be affiliated with people that you like that are still at top of their game 30 years later. No one's ever done that, you know? I always think, who else is out there? You know, and there really isn't anybody. I mean, to me. And, you know, I might have the attitude of, you know, I'm an older person looking back, you know. It's almost like they're like the last of the big bands or the good bands from that era, when it seemed like there was a lot more bands that were just super prominent and just like, you know, really individualistic and had their own thing. And, you know, now it just kind of seems like... Well, I'm probably a bad person to talk about now because I'm not really you know, I'm not really as involved with that stuff now. I mean, I'm definitely more outside of it, you know. But some of that is because of, you know, having a daughter and being a parent, but also, you know, I'm 50 years old, you know. It's gonna take a little bit more to get me excited, I guess. I think that's just natural. But, you know, maybe there's a bunch of 50-year-old guys that are like, things are better, are way better now, and that's cool. But from my viewpoint, the Melvins represent the last band standing.
Yeah, like, I think like, you know, not to take away from anything anyone else has done since or will
do.
Oh,
yeah, of course.
But yeah, you're right.
I don't want to dismiss whatever people are doing now that is good and... You know.
Yeah, but you're right. They are for that era, like that band to be the last band standing too, is says something because they are the band that, you know, without them, the era that has come would be very different, right? Like it would be a very different world without the Melvins. And I'm not just saying that because of like the influence they've had on like my band and Neurosis and like bands like that, you know, and stuff like that. But there would be no Nirvana. Like there would be no Nirvana without the Melvins. Like, and that's not to mince words.
That is the truth. That also bothers a lot of people. And that also is kind of why they're, you know, seems like the Melvins are always like, you'll be in the movie Juno. Talk about the movie Juno in the script, but you're not going to be on the $1 million selling soundtrack. That's always how it's gone for them. Always. Always. So the Nirvana thing is just another extension of that. I remember, like, you know, one of the first visits, Dale showed me a video. Yeah, I was playing drums with a couple friends of mine back up, you know, in Aberdeen or whatever they're from. And it was like, it was okay. It's okay. Well, Dell's playing, so he's sure making them sound good. And that's exactly what I thought. I didn't think, man, holy shit. You know, listen to that. That's really what I thought. My other funny, you know, they got some good songs for sure, you know. But, you know, I was never like, having said that, I totally understand how pivotal Nirvana were for a lot of people because they introduced of millions of people to this underground culture, and you know, I gotta give them that. You know, I mean, they really and they helped out some people just by talking about them, and they exposed all kinds of people to things like Black Flag or whatever. I never would have heard of that stuff. So you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, but at the time, of seeing like that video, I was like, whatever. You know. And years later, a few years later, Buzz called and was like, my friends in Nirvana are looking for a drummer. Do you want a phone number? Like, maybe you might want to try into spot. Maybe I'd want to try out for Nirvana. And I was like, and I said, nah, I don't really like Nirvana. This is like right before Dave Grohl joined. Buzz called Dave Grohl and tipped him off. And that's why, you know, obviously Dave Grohl's, you know, he's a great drummer, you know. But yeah, that's kind of funny to think about that. Like I also wasn't really ambitious. I was really scared, really, the idea of doing that. But if I was going to do something like that, it would be like, well, you can join Black Flag. Okay, that would be something. That never would have happened, you know. And you know, I wasn't really. I couldn't say I was a good enough drummer to do that. But I remember quite clearly just saying, nah, that's okay. I don't, you know. Which is kind of funny. That's like I never called them or anything. I was just like, nah, that doesn't sound like anything I want to do.
Were you into the Bleach record or not even?
It was okay. You know, like by the time all that Sub Pop stuff started happening, I already had heard the Melvins. And they go, I don't need to hear. And I always ended up being really disappointed by all those bands when I saw them live, because none of them were ever any good live. None of them. I remember seeing Soundgarden. They were a total snore fest. And I liked that first record. And when the sites like the Melvins coming out of the Pacific Northwest, you know, there was already Poison Idea and the Wipers. And I liked both those bands far more. I mean, you know, there's definitely some good stuff on Sub Pop, but I already had heard the Melvins, and I already knew and liked Poison Idea and the Wipers. And, you know, it seemed like a lot of the Sub Pop stuff was like, just not very exciting ultimately, or just just long last to me, you know, I'm not speaking for anybody else, but yeah, that's what I thought that back then, I guess.
So how did you get, like, did you, when you moved to North Carolina, did you see the Slush Puppies? I'm just like, how did you get into the more indie rock stuff? Cause then you wind up playing in these more kind of mellow indie-ish.
And all that stuff.
Yeah. And
well, Mac was, the Slush Puppies were a band that Mac had.
Yeah.
You
from Superchunk.
Superchunk.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were good. You know, it was like, again, the climate was hardcore is pretty much dead, or that version of hardcore, you know, like how fast can you keep playing? You know, it just got old after a while, you know, and Mac was another one of those guys that probably had a Minor Threat record and these other records and just started playing slower and writing more songs. And, you know, I remember thinking the Slush Puppies are really good. And he was already friends with some of the COC sort of access or just, you know, whatever. Everybody knew each other. You know, it was small enough to where everybody, even if you didn't like somebody, you still had no choice but to know them. You know, it was that kind of thing. And he was just one of those guys. And there were all these other people that maybe liked hardcore, but also always, there was always a lot of very diverse people in North Carolina, musically speaking, you know. You know, that's really where I caught up, because I'd never really heard a lot of stuff, like anything from, like, you know, Bauhaus to the Scientists to Neil Young. I never really had heard that much Neil Young, except for maybe the Live Rush record when I was a kid. So I was kind of being hit by all these things around, you know, summer of 86, and a lot of those people that also kind of were doing the same thing, they all sort of found each other. It was like, as nauseating as this term is, post-hardcore, that's pretty much what it was, you know. But this Raleigh's version of it. And I met Mac and a bunch of other people, and all these bands came up, and I think Wayne Taylor, who was the guy in No Labels, the pre-COC band that I brought up earlier, he knew everybody, and he was friends with Mac, and he was like, if you play with us, you know, I'll buy you a drum set if you play with us. I said, that sounds like a good deal. And that's how Wax started.
So was that your first band? You didn't do any drumming when you first got to North Carolina until Wax?
Yeah.
And it's just Wax, like, right? Played... You don't pronounce the first W?
I just always called it Wax, but, you know, some people called it Wax. I never got the official information on how we were supposed to pronounce it. I think people just did both, you know. But either way, it's fine, you know. And we just played. Mac knew a lot of people. You know, he was a pretty enterprising guy, and we played shows with a lot of, you know, definitely different sort of bands that I barely remember. Like a band called Big Dipper that were around.
Yeah,
we
great
played
band.
With them. We played with Honor Roll a few times. We played with, we played with Fugazi one time.
Oh, really? In North Carolina or somewhere else?
It was in Chapel Hill, yeah. Yeah, that was fine, you know. And we, again, it was one of those things that the band only lasted a year, and then after it was over, because Mac went back to school, wherever he went, I guess it was New York or whatever, and then he, you know, he was enterprising. I mean, there are other people that are enterprising, too. Like, Wayne helped put out this box set of music that all these North Carolina bands that existed at that time.
Yeah, the Slush Puppies are on that, and is Wax on that, too?
Wax were on it, Black Girls, Angels of Epistemology, and the Egg. There's a band, Egg. They were from a band called Stillborn Christians, who were an amazing band from North Carolina, like total kind of like Gang of Four, Minutemen, with Joe Biafra kind of vocals and guitar playing that kind of sounds like what that guy from the Jesus Lizard would end up being noticed for, but this other guy did all that stuff way back then, just weird jazz chords and stuff like that. And those guys formed the band Egg. You know, it's like a post-hardcore kind of thing, but, you know, they weren't like kids with mohawks jumping off the stage at these shows, but it was, you know, some of the same kind of energy. It was just kind of different, you know. It was still rooted in all that stuff, you know. And at that time, it was like, you know, the hardcore stuff, you know, it was like stuff was coming out for other people, I guess, you know, like Crippled Youth and Youth of the Day and the people that liked that, you know, it was just, they appealed to a different audience. So, yeah.
But like, and then I guess around this point, When did the 7 Seconds, when did you do that artwork for 7 Seconds?
I wrote letters to Kevin, you know, probably like 83, 84, because, you know, I read Maximum Rock and Roll, and there were all these scene reports, and I heard, you know, about everything, and they were another one of those bands I liked, and I wrote to him, and he wrote back, and, you know, I only really met them like a handful of times, like maybe twice, really, because, you know, I wasn't like some long friend, you know. We've been bros for years, whatever. But I guess they liked that drawing, and they put it on their album cover. But I did know, besides meeting them a few times, I wrote a few letters to Kevin, you know, and that's how that happened. They just liked it.
And they just put it on the cover. So that's, but like, you're in North Carolina at that point, or no, you're still on the West Coast?
Oh no, I was still in California. I didn't move to North Carolina until about like April of 86, May of 86.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So I was still there, you know, and I was still like writing letters and stuff and all that kind of thing. But I already had made up my mind that I was going to move and just flee from my family and just start over. I figured I could do that, you know, so I did.
So after, cause Wax, you guys do 2 7-inches?
Yeah. 2 7-inches.
The one on Merge and then the one in the box set, right?
Leopard Gecko, maybe?
Leopard Gecko, yeah.
They also put out like a, I can think of somebody from that band, Seaweed, that I barely remember. And I think that guy also put out like a Melvin's Oven 7-inch.
The one that you did the art for.
Ever for.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Ripped off the New Mutants stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was a huge New Mutants fan, so, and that was kind of like the, you know, comics were what I was into immediately before I got into music. So it was a bridge seeing that graphic for me, Brian. So I appreciate that for you.
No problem. Here to help.
So I guess you're doing art after or before Wax, and then Wax is going. And so when Wax breaks up, you meet Brian Adams while Wax is going, right? He comes to meet you at a show. I think I read this in Manchild.
That's years later. I had some wilderness years where, you know, like after I moved out there in Wax, and after that was over, there were some other bands that came toward the end of the 80s. There was Willard. That was a short-lived band. And when all that was going on, 89, that was like 89.
Did Willard release anything?
Willard self-released a cassette of our first demo. And we ended up having a single come out after we broke up that somebody in Chapel Hill was nice enough to put out, like probably by 91 or 92. But I stopped drawing, really. I just kind of got burned out with everything, and I was kind of growing up in public, if you can call it that, just being part of being a young person trying to figure out what he's going to do or whatever, you know. Certain amount of drama attached to that, of course, and I just got tired of drawing punk stuff. I didn't really feel that way anymore, and I just wanted to play drums, I guess, and live as cheaply as possible with no real goals, you know. I did that for a long time, so we, you know, I did some of that stuff, and Ryan, it was probably 92 or 93. He was from Jacksonville, which is about 2 hours away, maybe more toward the beach, and he was friends with another guy that used to call me named Jerry McElwain, and he was kind of like the punk rock dad for a lot of those kids out there that lived in these weird places in North Carolina, which is kind of a strange place to come from trying to get into like punk rock or whatever, because you're as isolated as anybody. And Jerry was like a big figure. He was kind of like Ryan's like father figure, protector, or what? I couldn't really figure it out. But I met Jerry first, then I met Ryan. And Ryan came up to me and Mac at a show. It was probably like 91 or whatever. And it's like, that Pumpkin 7-inch changed my life. And we were just kind of laughing at him and like, go away, kid, or whatever. And that's how I first met him. And then he kept popping up over and over. You know, like, man, we should play. I really want to play with you. It's like, yeah, whatever, kid. And then he finally gave me a tape of a cassette of all the stuff he had recorded, and I was like, whoa, this guy's talented, you know, because I was like, oh yeah, well put your money where your mouth is, and he did, and I was like, wow, you know, he had some stuff that sounded like that REM kind of southern thing that I wasn't really into. But then he had stuff that sounded just like Honor Roll, and he sung just like their singer, Bob Schick. It was really unnerving. I was like, okay, well, maybe I should play with him. So we started to play, and that's how the Patty Duke stuff started. But that was like, you know, probably a couple of years into the 90s, I guess.
What was it, like 94 you guys put out that? Or did that demo ever actually like come out back then or no?
Fuck no, that demo never came out. Well, two songs ended up on this record that a split single with this other band, Glamour Puss. Glamour Puss were a band, there was a couple in that band. Girl named Chidi Kumar and this guy, her boyfriend, Paul Seiler. And they were like that year's version of ambitious people, you know, people that actually could like get things going and put out records, or whatever. And so they liked us, and we were on one side of a record, and their band was on the other. And other than that, none of that stuff has ever come out, and it's probably never going to come out, you know. But two songs did come out.
Wow, I didn't even know recorded. That. I had no idea that that record exists.
Yeah, it's like some high-priced eBay sort of thing for people that are fans of him. You know, people. I think so. I think a few of them, I've been told that people have spent like just an absurd amount of money for this split 7-inch because he's on it.
Do you still have test press? Yeah. Do you have a test press?
No, I don't think I have. I don't have a copy. I think I think I might've, I don't even remember, but no, I don't even have a copy for whatever reason.
Well, you never hold on to your own stuff, right? Like you never like, oh, this is going to be something I really care about. A long time from now.
I seem to have like, well, you know, I've never really held, I don't really have a lot of stuff. I mean, I have more stuff now than I ever, but I'm not like really a pack rat. And I kind of sold all my records like, you know, super long time ago, mainly because I was just, it seemed like I had to move once a year, every year in Raleigh. So there's nothing worse than moving records. And, you know, I just kind of sold them right before that eBay craze, right before I realized people would spend like thousands of dollars. It was actually, to be honest, it was just sort of a freeing thing. And every once in a while I think, well, you know, it'd be kind of cool to have 1,000 records, but I don't know. I don't really think about it too much. I haven't been in a record store in ages. The last time I went to a record store, I just ran out just in terror. Like, you know, having 1,000 records didn't really help or something. I don't know. Or I'll just go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, when Steve McDonald was on the podcast, he was saying because of his brother's bullying of his music choice when he was a kid, when he goes to a record store to this day, he immediately has to shit. Just like a nervous reaction.
I'll tell you what it is. It was like, I was into buying as many records. I bought so many records, and I always had that mental list that, you know, most people have when they're really into looking for, I'm going to look for this kind of record. Hopefully this will be there. And I'd spend like 2 or 3 hours in a record store. And I definitely did my time of being that obsessive sort of, you know, like a lot of people. And there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, I guess I got tired of it. So now when I go into a record store and I see people sitting there for like 3 hours and there's cobwebs growing on them and stuff, I just run out in terror. It's almost like this claustrophobic feeling. And it just reminds me of how much time I had put in so many hours of being that guy and like making 1,000 cassette compilations for people and spreading the good word and being really into it, that when I was not into it, I just wasn't really into it. And, you know, every once in a while I'll think of something, yeah, it'd be nice to have that again, but, you know, I don't purposely go anywhere to find it, you know. And everything's online now anyway, you know, I mean, for better or for worse, you know, I don't know if it's better or worse, but, you know, there's tons of people that have all that stuff and they have no problem putting it up there. So if I want to hear, if I don't happen to have a copy of the Neo's Hazaban record, Hazaban, whatever, there's probably five places I can hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like, did you keep your correspondences though? Like all the letters?
Not really.
No.
That actually is probably more upsetting than any record collection I got rid of. You know, I had so much funny stuff and just some poignant stuff too, you know, like, you know, for some 14-year-old girl with a mohawk that lives in Alabama writing, I'm so alienated, I'm all alone, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, everything's very dramatic, more so when you're like, you know, 18 years old. Or
I can imagine being
17.
Yeah, 18 with a mohawk in Alabama in 1984 being a little scary.
Yeah, it's probably a little alienating, you know, a little strange. Yeah, you know, so I had a lot of letters like that, and yeah, that's the stuff I kind of wish I held on to, but I, you know, I didn't, and a lot of that had to do with just moving all the time, you know, which, you know, but what's done is done.
Yeah,
know?
Absolutely. But well,
it would be nice to have, though.
Oh, it would be, like, and I think that's one of those things that, but, like, you know, like no one really thought, you know, like you don't think in the moment that this is something you're going to be able to look back on, you know, like you
oh,
said,
yeah, totally.
Everyone's living for
totally.
That.
I mean,
second.
all that stuff is a huge influence on me, of course. And, you know, in a way it still is, but it was so long ago, you know, it really was. So it's not something I really think about too much, but you know, the influence of course is still there, you know, I mean, If me and Buzz are joking about Doug Moody in the year 2015, you know, for better or for worse, you know, the kids would love it. You know, that stuff is a huge, those reference points, as archaic as they are, you know, that stuff was, everything about all that, that subculture was very influential, the good and the bad, you know. But, you know, again, it's, you know, it's there, but it you know, like when I'm taking care of my daughter, I'm not sitting there going, boy, that, I wonder when that Manifest Destiny Mystic record came out, you know?
You can find that out now. There, you go on Discogs and you can just check that out.
That's right. That's right. You know, I did all these cartoons like, and like a little very limited book called Middle Age Rebel, which is sort of about me and just, you know, growing up and being an old dude, like, well, what am I going to do now? You know? And then just thinking about doing all these parent things and adult things, and then in the back of your mind, you're thinking about, suddenly you're thinking of a Husker Du record or just something like, you know. You know, during really inappropriate times. You know. When did Zen Arcade come out again? Like some totally useless trivia that is nothing you could use in your real life, your real everyday life, you know. That's the kind of stuff I'm good at. You know, like, when are your parents' birthdays? I barely remember my parents' birthdays. What year, what's the exact order of Husker Du's records between 1981 and 1985? Oh, that's easy. You know, like, rattle it off, you know. That's that sort of selective memory thing, obsessed selective memory, you know, where you remember some things and then all this other stuff that's probably most people would say is not not really very important. You still remember it. And, you know, that's kind of how I am, you know.
Well, in the realm of this podcast, it is all that sort of stuff is super important, you know, like for this world, like that, like, you know, and I think that's the thing, like, it's just amazing to think like how many influential worlds you've been involved in, you know, and like directly involved in, and like, you know, like there's so much stuff I could talk to you for like another 2 hours. Like, I want to find out what your thoughts were when the first time you heard 10-foot pole, you know, like,
right. Oh, I'll tell you, I wasn't here when all that, like, literally when I moved away, it was, you know, it was before that stuff, that style of music had become what it is.
Yeah. It was, and like Bad Religion had just put out some, like,
I didn't like any of that stuff. I remember, like, NoFX were fucking horrible. They were a horrible band. You know, they were nice enough guys. I mean, you could say the same thing about numerous bands from back then, like Mystic related bands, you know. That was a real surprise, but I just wasn't into that, you know, kind of thing. So I was happy, you know, and I still am. I'm happy for those guys that, you know, I really like Scott a lot, and I think they do that stuff just fine. But, you know, I was definitely not, you know, even if I was living there, I don't think I would have been into it, you know, because it just seemed like this stuff just sounds like, it was just nothing I was really into. You know, I just felt like I already had heard that kind of stuff, and more power to all those people, you know, of course. I just kind of thought, I'm not really, but you know, it's certainly better played music than Scared Straight was, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. You know? Well, no, I don't agree with that. Actually, I don't know why I'm agreeing with that. I don't think the early note, like that stuff, is better than Scared Straight.
Oh, I mean, like maybe that 10-foot pole. Right?
Oh, they have
I mean,
a pole.
The way it sounds
oh, yeah.
and how they're playing, you know.
Yeah, it's more proficient.
You know what I mean? It's like produced better. You know, maybe it's influenced by what are the record labels again? Epitaph and
Epitaph and Fat Records.
Fat Records, yeah. I know nothing about any of that stuff. Like Scott was like, "Have you ever heard of Strung Out? No. Pennywise? Nope. I've never heard any of that stuff. None of it to this day. Never heard any of that stuff." And the only band that Scott played for me when I stayed with him that I was like, okay, was that Propaganda band. That was it. I was like, this is kind of like the Voivod of this style of music. These guys are, you know, I could see right away. And they happen to be Canadian, too.
And
so no figure.
They would have
and everything
to be,
else.
They would be so flattered hearing that analogy. Like, they probably have
okay,
more
guys,
love for
well,
Voivod.
You guys are like, well, I'll say it right. I'll say it again. Those guys are like, I like Voivod for that style of music to everybody else's mediocre Metallica. How's that?
Okay, I think that will do it. They will be
but,
stoked.
Know.
They will be stoked. They are big metalheads, like before they got into punk rock. So
yeah, I listened to his interview, and he was, you know, how he came into it through like speed metal and metal and whatever.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about this, like, you know, doing the podcast is like I just love. You know, like all these heroes of mine, like yourself, him, like all these people that went on to play in all these bands that had big impacts on me and things like that, like finding out like how close they were to taking a different
connected.
Path.
Yeah. Totally connected. Like,
yeah.
Like a good example is like on the last Melvin story, I ran to Carl Alvarez, the guy that plays bass in the Descendants.
Yeah.
Role.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was really great. We had dinner in Fort Collins and I hadn't seen him in like 15 years in a physical sense, and it was like exactly like how I just talked, how we talked earlier about maybe before you started the tape recorder, about how like you can be friends with somebody and maybe not see them for like 15 years or 10, but you because you had sort of the same background, you can just pick right up where you left off, and that was exactly what it was with Carl. It was like one of those rare things because, you know, we both came from the same sort of universe as, you know, the Melvins came from and other people our age, you know, and that was really great. And then you just kind of learned that a lot of people are sort of connected in this weird way because they were just involved in their version of the same thing from back then, if that makes sense. Kind of like Vietnam, but way less dramatic, you know, with badly recorded 7-inches as your calling card, you know, and it was great. That stuff doesn't happen all the time. So when it does, I really appreciate it. You know, it's cool. And it's interesting to look back and see, like, the Dinosaur Jr. guys. I don't really know those guys very well. You know, I've met Lou a few times. He's nice. And those guys all came out of the same sort of, you know, early 80s, buy a record through the mail sort of thing, you know, process. You know, I could totally have a good time talking about some stupid records that we had, you know. They have the same sort of background.
I could honestly... I could put you, Fat Mike from NoFX, and Jay Maskus in a room with the Neo 7-inch, and just based on conversations I've had with all three of you separately, know that you could three jive talking about just the Neo 7-inch, like immediately.
We could talk about the Neo 7-inch for about an hour, probably. That was the one conversation I had with Jay Maskus. I drew a bunch of stuff. He came up and saw I did a Neo's parody poster. Yeah, but it was Buzz's acoustic tour, you know. Buzz Osborne, how's the guy gets the Martian brain squeeze? Yeah, that's going to be sold right away, you know. He walks up, he looks at all the stuff, and I've always heard that he's kind of slow. Slow, not the biggest conversationalist. Maybe, I heard when you get him going, it's no problem. But
as long as you talk about something he wants to talk about, he's great.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go to him and say, boy, you know, well, you know, I think it'd be pretty easy to stay away from whatever. But, you know, 80s hardcore, that probably would have something to say about that. So he sees the Neos thing, he says something like, I like that poster. And I went, thanks, man. And then he said, "That's one of my favorite records of all time." I went, "Oh yeah, me too." And it's this awkward silent thing. He walked away. And then later somebody said, "Boy, he really opened up. He really got him talking."
Yeah.
He said in this conversation about my Neo's parody poster, you know, which I sold, bizarrely enough, you know.
Well, I noticed actually back there, it's funny watching when I was at that show in Nashville and I was standing by the merch booth with you, just watching like people buy these obscure references that you have on these posters. And I'm like, I wonder if these people are getting the reference that's on the poster, or they're just buying it because they love the drawing.
It might be both. Some people have really surprised me, you know, like, yeah, I mean, because a lot of the references are really not for a normal everyday person to know or appreciate. So, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to, you know, get it. And some of them are really obscure, you know. Sometimes that's part of the fun, is just seeing, you know, if anybody gets it. You know, because everybody, those posters I sell at the Melvin shows when I do their, you know, their merchandise, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, it's pretty, anything about Kurt Cobain, you know, or whatever, those are pretty, people will get it. You know, usually this, you know, those kind of things that are more widespread, people will, you know, but a Neo's poster, you know, who's going to get that? And yet people, I've been surprised. I'm still surprised, you know, so it might be some combination of both, though, you know. Maybe some people just, you know, like I've done the Meat Puppets first, you know, their first 7-inch, that cover. That's like one of my favorite, that's like one of my favorite covers, that little scribble. It's just really demented looking. It's like, what the fuck is this? And then you hear it, and it's just like, ah! You know, this insane record with these little kind of mutated country sort of licks thrown in there. That's a classic record. I've done that a billion times with the Melvins, and I always sell them. So, you know, there's somebody out there that would appreciate it, you know. But, yeah, I've been surprised, you know, really surprised. I mean, you know, selling a Neo's parody poster to somebody in fucking, you know, Rhode Island, you know, who would think? And yet, there you go. You know, it happens, yeah. I mean, I've met a lot of people that, or, you know, a lot of times selling stuff, and it's like you're like a bartender, basically, you know, a lot of drunk people. But every so often, there's always that person that comes up that you can really have a good time talking to, and they kind of understand that selective, bizarre, obsessive kind of trait that maybe I have. And, you know, a good time will be had by all, you know. There's a lot of mainly guys, of course. You know, mainly other older guys.
But there's certainly women too. But yeah, it's a lot of.
There's certainly women. There's certainly women
era.
Too. But you know, I have yet to have a woman walk up and buy that Captain Beefheart parody. If you know, you know, it seems like it's mainly dudes that have that.
Beefheart does have like a decided.
Male only vibe.
Yeah, a lot of dudes on that show. A lot of dudes.
I can't imagine like a front row of women just going nuts over Captain Beefheart in any era.
I can't even imagine a front row of young. I was going to say a lot of dudes, a lot of older men for Beefheart. I think at this point, like, and I put myself in that category too because I do enjoy some Beefheart, but it's not. He's not scooping up those young millennials. And
Fuck no. They'd run the other way in terror. What the hell is this shit? I'm not going to listen to this.
Brian, I could talk to you, man, for another hour and a half, because I honestly would love to have you on again for a part two and a part three. Cause...
Oh, I'm definitely up for it. You just let me know. We can figure it out. I really had a good time. I really appreciate you letting me be involved in this. When I heard some of the other podcast things, like the John Spencer interview and the Jay Maskus one, and you know, of course the Melvins one, those are all really great. They were really interesting. So like you're doing God's work.
That is the highest praise I could ask for. And
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.